Good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about loving kindness, but in a secular sense. Or maybe we can say in terms of the Sutra Last Sutra, relativistic or a relativistic sense of loving kindness. Now, I'm not a counselor or a psychologist, but I'm from the limited view that I get in working with people who are, I'm wondering if there isn't a bit of a turn toward the spiritual and some of the practices of counseling these days. I checked that out with Jeff actually the other day. He said he thought that at least for some people there are. And I've probably mentioned before that I'm part of a group that discusses motivational interviewing from a family mediation perspective. And the founders, the sort of granddaddies of motivational interviewing, Miller and Rolnick, but particularly Miller, have certainly taken a turn toward at least outing spiritual things. I don't know where they're coming from. They may have been there, I suspect, all the time, but it may not have been kosher, so to speak, to allude to them early in the 80s when they started this particular approach to counseling, which is a very respectful, very person-centered way of relating to people. They're now, I think, in about the fourth edition of their book, but if in the third edition, they actually start mentioning it, and they introduce the very weird term from our point of view, compassion, into their vocabulary, and they start talking about the spirit of motivational interviewing, not just the technique. The techniques, I guess, are tried and true because it seems to be permeating everything from sports performance to drug addiction and working with prisoners as well, and just a whole range of things. And as they bring this idea of in the spirit of motivational interviewing front and center, they write, "In spirit, motivational interviewing overlaps with millennia-old wisdom on compassion that crosses time and cultures and how people negotiate with each other about change." Now, William Miller has gone one step farther. There's this little book here with a very radical title for psychology, it seems to me, of loving kindness. He makes a big point of putting the words together, so it's a single word, I guess a little bit to distinguish it from some of the other uses of it. And ordinarily, I'm very suspicious with the popularization of concepts that we're familiar with in one context, sort of wrested out of that context and into something else. But this seems to me to be worth considering, at least in our relativistic world that we operate, our day-to-day world as we operate. So he sees loving kindness as an element that's common to many of the world's major religions and spiritual traditions. And he actually goes farther than that and calls it a default condition of human nature, that we are naturally prone toward loving kindness. That reminds me a little bit of, well, the Buddhist idea that we all have the Buddha within us that we can access if we choose to do that and if we're capable of doing it. Or the Quakers talk about the spark of the divine in everyone. And in Confucianism, Mencius, the sort of second progenitor of Confucianism, talks about our natural inclination toward doing good as water runs downhill. That doesn't mean you can't dam it and make it go uphill, you know, or pump it or something. But that's we naturally are inclined to sort of helpful human or compassionate nature. It's really a way of being, it seems to me. He calls it a habit of the mind and heart, loving kindness. So he, in a social scientific way, perhaps, he said there are key characteristics of it, overarching ones, and then he talks about choices that we make. The key characteristics that Miller mentions are that it's chosen. It's something we choose to do. It's enacted. It's something we, you know, bodily do or practice. It's empathic, working with, getting on the side of those other people. It's selfless, and it's consistent. He has a list which is not exhaustive, he says, and really just suggestive of where he's coming from. And he mentions 12 choices we make, he calls them. So we can choose to act, to be in certain ways. And we're not going to go through all 12 of them. I'll take one of them as an example in a minute. So he talks about the choices we make as being compassionate, empathic, content, generous, hopeful, affirming, forgiving, patient, humble, grateful, yielding. And in that little book, he's got chapters. These are very short chapters, about 5 pages. These, it's not exhaustive. So this is the way we are affirming. This is the way we are hopeful. But he also talks about, you know, what gets in the way of doing things, of doing these things. The obstacles he mentions, the overarching ones, seem very familiar to me in Zen terms. He talks about inattention, fear and anger, and privilege as blocking us from being lovingly kind. And that strikes me. Inattention resonates a bit with ignorance, it seems to me. Fear and anger with hatred, and privilege with greed. Despite those similarities, it certainly is different. His approach is very different from the approach of metta, which is the Pali word that we translate in English as loving kindness. So metta, of course, is central to Buddhism, but as a meditative practice based on a specific sutra, so there is a very short sutra in the Buddhist canon about metta. And in Zen, and again, there are different approaches there, and I can't really comment on Vipassana, there may be others in the room who can say more about it, but what is suggested is that in Zen, metta is a concentration and mindfulness practice, just a very clear focus, so we can wish to others what we wish for ourselves, and we may have our own way of expressing that. I think people may, you know, on the basis of metta, have their own particular formulas. I know I have mine, which I incidentally usually start out with in the first session of our session, or just ordinary meditation, or Zazen Kai. Try to go around the room in our group and practice with the fellow meditators in this case. So that it's in Vipassana, according to what I've read, it's more of an insight meditation, more generally about wisdom, about the way the world is, rather than these specific types of wishes that we might express. So in Zen, it invites the practitioner into a more loving, connected state of mind with other people, the people we're thinking of. So that's different from the way Miller deals with it, though he may be inspired by that. Nevertheless, it strikes me, at least in our day-to-day world, that some of his suggestions are very useful. They actually remind me a little bit of some of the precepts that are important in Zen. So I'm going to take just one of them because it's a practice that I've been trying just very recently. All this is very new to me, and the book is new to me. And I'm just trying to see how I relate to it. So I chose contentment because I often feel very discontented about my inner world, my personal world, and say nothing of the outer world, the world out there, which just, it's very hard to be content, I think, with what's going on in many places around the globe. So contentment, which Miller defines as joyful acceptance of enough. Joyful acceptance of enough. And in his method, he then contrasts it with the relevant neutral and opposite position. So that's what he does in each chapter. And he talks about forward and backward and neutral. And this is the forward position would be acceptance, joyful acceptance of enough. The neutral one, in this case, he says, is discontent. And the opposite position, the negative one, is envy or jealousy. And he suggests, as he does for each one of those 12 choices that we can make, he suggests practices to go with it. And there are several that he suggests in this case. One that despite my own, well, I wouldn't say despite, I guess, but my own Jewish background, but I've never formally studied Jewish thought in a systemic way at all, and have not been bar mitzvah. He talks about a practice called Dainu, which is a weekly practice, as far as I can see, in which prayer, I guess it is repeated, which has lines in it that say, it would have been sufficient if God had only given, and then add one blessing to that, like release from slavery in Egypt, or the Torah, or something. If it would have been sufficient, it would have been okay if we only had this one. But it's really nice that he or she or it, you know, gave us more than that. But it would have been okay. We would have been better off without slavery than being slaves. We're very grateful for the Torah. We didn't have that before. We didn't have that guidance. But it would have been okay if that was all that we were gifted. And two others suggest, so that would be possible. He said you can make a list of things that you're grateful for having and then add one to it and say, well, it would have been okay if I didn't have that one. Perhaps more familiar to us, he talks about fasting. We, of course, know what that means in terms of diet, in terms of eating, but it can be applied to anything. Stopping some sort, or putting at least the temporary halt to some habitual behavior, like eating at a certain time, but it can amount to any kind of behavior that you normally do, and to fast, to at least for a short time or a specific amount of time, suspend that and see, and say, well, life goes on, you know, if we have to wait, well, in case of the Muslims, what, after sundown, is that right? That between sunrise and sundown, we don't eat. Normally, we might eat quite a lot between those two times. And for a month, that goes on for Ramadan, as far as I understand. Or refraining, what he calls refraining from a certain behavior. And to me, it's a little bit of a confusion. But the way he defines it is purposely putting yourself in a situation where you would want to do something and don't do it. Now, his example is an interesting one, and I certainly haven't tried it. Go to your favorite fast food outlet and just sit there and you know, breathe in the aroma of the food that you normally really like and walk out again afterwards. So just refrain from purchasing whatever it is that you're very used to eating. Now, I can't say I have vast experience of trying any of these, and my own practice here is perhaps not a very deep one because it has to do with muffins. Now, I have a favorite. I try to get a couple times a week a little bit of exercise and cycling, and my turnaround point is this really nice little cafe in Diamond Creek. And he makes very good muffins as well as very, he's a coffee specialist, but he also makes very good muffins. I don't know. I think he uses an old woman's weekly recipe. They're not gooey in the middle. You know, they have fruit and all. They're really nice. So then I treat myself to a muffin halfway and catch my breath, have a coffee muffin, turn around, go back. Okay. What happens if I don't have my muffin and just turn around and just look at the, Maybe it's refraining because I can see the cafe where my turnaround point at the end of the, okay, there it is. I sometimes, oh, a lot of people there today. You know, okay, but I've got it. I said today, I'm not going to do it. So in a sense, I've fasted in that broader sense that Miller's talking about. And I've done that for a couple of weeks. And now, in a sense, I can take it or leave it. So sometimes I have a muffin, sometimes I don't have a muffin. But I'm not riding with the aim of getting a muffin. I'm riding with the aim of riding. And maybe, perhaps, you know, or not even think about it, just hop on the bike and then see how I feel when I get there. So that's my very deep practice in the relativistic world of muffins and cyclists. But I find it, in a way, oddly liberating. It didn't occur to me that I could do my bike ride without my muffin, because I always get my muffin. And I even phone ahead because he runs out of muffins. So I ring up Susie. Hi, Susie. Hi, Tom. Any muffins around? Ah, oh, just, you know, we've got a new batch coming out of the oven. Oh, get on my bike. Okay. All right, but there's a serious side to it. But I guess for practice, starting with something that's relatively easy and seeing if you can modify the habit or break the habit, and be content with or without a muffin. And maybe that's transcending the relativistic world to a more absolute one. It doesn't matter, muffin or no muffin. So this is about contentment. I'm content with or without my muffin. So Miller's essentially secular in this broader approach to loving kindness, as illustrated as in the one of the 12 choices he says we can make, is not the same as the meta practice. And I'm not saying that we can substitute that. We have a muffin sutra instead of the meta. But I believe, at least on our day-to-day plane of living, it may be something that people would like to try.